we are going to talk about the goodwill and the impairments, and I give the floor to Michelle.
The main focus of this meeting is looking at the impairment requirements. So if it doesn't cause too much trouble, I'd like to reverse the order of the papers and start with paper 18C and then move on to 18B and deal with 18A last.
All right.
During the post-implementation review, we heard concerns that the current impairment test requirements are costly and complex to apply, and that there are some shortcomings in the information provided to investors. So we think there are two objectives to looking at the impairment requirements. Firstly, considering if there are ways we can make the impairment test less onerous for preparers without affecting the quality of information to users. And secondly, considering whether better, more timely information can be provided to users with still achieving an appropriate cost-benefit balance. Now, papers 18B and 18C for this meeting look at the second objective. However, we will come back to the first objective at a future meeting, for example, considering changes such as whether we should provide relief from the annual impairment test for goodwill. So I suggest we start with paper 18C, which is exploring whether there are ways we could modify the impairment test to respond to users' concerns rather than solely relying on disclosures. Now, we're in the early stages of developing the approach in paper 18C that we have called the day zero impairment test. So this meeting is really just to test the waters to see what board members' initial views are on developing this approach further. So do board members have any comments on or suggestions on the approach in paper 18C?
Sue?
I just wanted to confirm my understanding of how this would work and when it would work best. So it would seem to me what the approach that the staff has analysed achieves is it helps try and identify overpayment at inception. So if you do the test at inception, if you had overpayment in a new acquisition, it stops goodwill that already existed in the cash generating unit from sort of creating a buffer to that being masked. But if there's changes in the amount of goodwill going forward in the sort of old part of the cash generating unit and the new part, it doesn't prevent sort of increases, for example, in the old piece creating a buffer for the acquired goodwill. Is that correct?
That's
so
correct,
it sort of helps on day one, but not so much over time?
Yeah.
My impression was that it also helps over time because that buffer remains.
Yes, a buffer on day one, but the buffer isn't changed then for any further increases.
No, I understand that, but possibly it might stay stable anyway.
Yeah, but if you had a situation where it doesn't work so well, is if you have a situation where the old part of the business, assuming you can even still see that, but the old part of the business has increasing goodwill, but the acquired part of the business had decreasing goodwill.
Yes.
The increasing internally generated goodwill could mask the downward movement in your acquired goodwill.
But are you taking account of the increase?
No, but because the recoverable amount takes it into account, indirectly it still sort of creates a buffering effect.
But as I understood the proposal, so even it's not just about identifying overpayment on day one, it also still leads to a more rapid trigger of impairment 2 years from now, because you won't be able to use the buffer in internally generated goodwill.
The day one.
Yeah, but if nothing much changes in a cash generating unit, then it's very likely that it remains rather stable anyway.
And I agree with that. My only question, I guess, when I looked at it, and I'll be interested to hear what the views of others are, because I haven't formed my own view yet until I hear what others say, is whether the cost of that extra test is justified given the fact that it really works best at inception and not so well over time.
Well, but it's a one-time cost, because you only estimate this buffer at inception, you don't repeat it.
True.
I think the big question is, isn't this highly subjective? Are we getting way deep into very theoretical territory? That's, I think, the main question. that it would help towards triggering earlier impairment, in even not just on day one, but also day or year two and year three. There's no question in my mind. But will the outside world accept this? No, Daryl.
I was going to say, I quite like the approach that you're suggesting here. I think starting point, as I understand it, and perhaps building a little bit on what Sue says. This could be a long year. Building a little bit on what Sue said is that essentially what you do is at the point, and I just to clear in my own mind, it's at the point that you combine old business with new, which may be, I presume, at the point of purchase, but might actually be at a later point. So at the point that you combine old business with new, you determine the old business goodwill, combine that with the new business, and then test the combined unit for whether the goodwill has declined. And then you maintain that old business remains a sort of a slug that lives forever, and you just keep testing against the slug of old business, and for that matter, the new that you purchase is also a slug that you don't change at all.
Yeah.
And then you're essentially applying a LIFO approach. So saying that at each remeasurement point, if there is a decline from that high water mark, any decline is assumed to come first out of the last purchased goodwill.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that subsequent part of the model is one that we've not really explored yet, but a LIFO approach would be a one to explore, I think.
So IFRS would finally accept LIFO.
So I think, and then to Sue's question, I think for me it feels like the additional cost increment that we're talking about is the determination of the existing goodwill of old business at the point that you create the CGU. Thereafter, it's the same test that you're conducting on an ongoing basis. There's no other change. And again, to Sue's point, you maintain that balance, so it's not like you have to remeasure it at any future point.
Only if you had another acquisition that gave
only
rise
if you had
to
another acquisition, and then a recreation of a new CGU with bits and pieces of old.
Gary,
thank you. It is Michelle, as you know, I have reservations on this page after this whole thing, and I'm not going to go through everything I've got right now. I'll wait and see how the discussion goes. But if I started, but I think your assumption is all the buffer is essentially internally generated goodwill. Is that?
Well, I've called it internally generating goodwill to make it easier, but it would just be the headroom in the cash generating unit acquisition.
So it would also include internally generated intangibles that have not been recognized, or even other increases in assets that haven't been recognized.
Well, it's also, but assuming the fair value is sort of a constant in this, and you're comparing it to your carrying value, everything else equal, if someone's got a more conservative accounting policy or a more liberal accounting policy that affects your carrying value, you have more or less buffer, correct? If I had a very conservative accounting policy, almost no assets, I would have a huge buffer. And I write off fixed assets quickly. I have I'm very conservative about when I start capitalizing development costs and, aggressive bad debt reserving policy, but I have very, relatively speaking, low carrying value. I'll have a bigger buffer.
Yes, the bigger the difference between recoverable amount and the carrying amount, the bigger the buffer.
I would say this.
Because you're trying to pull the buffer out of the equation, in effect, in terms of it's not available for cover or against an overpayment. That's what you're trying to accomplish in this, right?
I think this would be neutral, though, in terms of what your accounting policies were. So that
if it's carrying value is the denominator, I don't know how it would be neutral.
Because when you are, what we're saying is that this additional amount that we'd add into the carrying value would be on top of your existing recognized amounts.
Mm-hmm.
So you're measuring that, when you're measuring from day zero, you're measuring it based on its recoverable amount at that date. Now that recoverable amount is going to be independent of the accounting policies you've used for
I'm
what
talking about the pre-existing stuff in the cash generating unit.
I agree.
What you're saying is you don't want the buffer to be available and to cover an overpayment. And you've defined the buffer as fair value less carrying value. What I'm just suggesting is that the lower the carrying value is, the more buffer you would exclude from it, if I follow, the formulas of this thing.
Yeah.
And that might just be determined by how conservative or liberal or aggressive someone is in selection of accounting policies, how you allocate assets to cash general units, and so on. But the other, but my notion is sort of confirmed that really is, you know, the buffer is dependent in part on its internal accounting. It has to be, if it's carrying value versus fair value.
Yes, there would be a consequence subsequently as you amortize the recognized assets away.
Right. But then the other, well, I've got many issues with it, but I'll ask one more for now. But is a lot of this still presumes you actually can identify an overpayment, you know? Overpayment and who eyes and how determined. I mean, I suspect a new acquisition, the CEO is not going to concede there's an overpayment. In time, it might prove to be an inopportune payment.
So that's why I think this proposal is not... Its value is not in identifying overpayments at the beginning, because no, since this is all highly subjective,
yeah,
there's no CEO is going to admit that he overpaid.
You do the buffer only on day one.
But the main value is that you have less wriggling room and will get into impairment quicker than in the current account. Chamu?
Thank you. With the same point as Gary suggested. Actually, I see this is a quite interesting idea to make the impairment loss to be recognized more timely and more enough in terms of amount. So very interesting. But the first thing is this approach is going to their complexity. To increase the robustness, we are going to add one more complexity to the impairment law testing model. That's my concern. Another thing is whether we can get our really reasonable, accurate number amount of this internally generated the goodwill. So the feasibility of this idea is another concern. And the final thing is the scope of this new approach is a little limited, because we can add this amount to a carrying amount only in the case of there is some existing CGUs. Other cases we cannot apply this approach. So another minor thing is a technical maybe thing is if we make some estimation of this internally generated good deal, we are going to use a fair value, right? Not the value in use.
Mm.
Value in use will be just used for the later in calculating the recoverable amount. So that's what I'm saying, you know, the more simple, the more robust approach to resolve this issue is eliminating BIU rather than, you know, adding a lot more complexity into the impairment test.
I can see by Martin's body language that he thinks this is an excellent idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's going to tell us now why.
But I think at least it is an interesting idea. But I don't think it will not work because it is, I think, 3 points. First, I think also what Zoom mentioned, because the buffer, which you maybe then measure at day one or day zero, I think can change. So the internal goodwill can also go up and down. And based on that, then if you then after that deduct really the buffer on day zero, I think you come to wrong conclusions regarding the impairment. So I think the approach can only work if you update this kind of internally goodwill every measurement date, which is very, very difficult, and therefore I think it will not work. Secondly, I think, okay, it will also not work if you have more than one acquisitions in one cash generating unit, because then I think you cannot really reliably measure what is then the buffer on day one without mixing what was the goodwill from the first acquisition and what is the second acquisition. Thirdly, I think also from a concept, I think it will not work because you're trying then to identify what is the overpayment. And as Hans said, okay, all the acquisitions, mind the board of managing directors is asking for a fairness opinion. Fairness opinion is really saying that you don't have done an overpayment, that you have really paid the fair value, the fair amount of this. And at the same date, then the entity would be required to come up with this overpayment analysis based on cash generating units. So they have two documents. One is saying, okay, so we have an overpayment of certain amount, and secondly, you have fairness opinions, which is saying you have paid a fair amount. So how does that fit together? I don't see.
But that's why I think.
And therefore, I think it will not work.
Proposal, actually. What is the essence of the proposal?
And a CEO should be fired.
But what this proposal lays fair is that what we are doing now is certainly wrong in all cases, because we do not take the internally generated goodwill into account. It can be used for the impairment test. And so, assuming that in most cases there will be internally generated goodwill and it might be sizable, the impairment test doesn't work. Because it does not, even if the acquisition has failed, you could have a big buffer to cover up the failure.
Well, a couple of observations. If the standard as it is written today creates an impediment or a disincentive to write off any overpayment upfront, that should be removed. Now, I agree with all the ones who said it will be very rare, infrequent, that someone will recognize having overpaid. Probably will never happen. But just in case it happens and you identify that you have overpaid, then I think the standard should not prohibit an immediate write-off of that overpayment, as apparently it is understood today that you cannot immediately. You have to wait for the next closing period, which could be 3 months down the road. It doesn't make a big difference, but still. So that should be removed. But I think it's very rare cases where that will apply. Now, regarding the use of the buffer, that might be a good idea, but in practice, the reality, many acquisitions are for diversification or are new entities that will not be allocated to an existing CGU. That will create a new CGU. So there is no way you can do what is proposed here. Or if you allocate to an existing CGU, let's assume the CGU is small, very small, and you make a big acquisition that will be allocated to the same new CGU. Then this buffer is very small and will not be something material to offset against the new goodwill. So again, that will be a limitation to the idea, because the effect of the overpayment using the existing buffer, if you have a small unit acquiring a big one, that doesn't work either. So I think we have to acknowledge that this would be helpful only if you have a relatively big CGU existing and you acquire a relatively small thing to add to this CGU. Then the big buffer existing that will be actually offsetting any excess payments on the new CGU. And the last thing on the little c, the idea to compare actual performance to expected performance, that is fine in principle. In reality, people will always put down conservative forecasts so that they will always meet the targets. They will not disclose the forecast as they may have it in mind, just to be safe and not to have to do a write-down based on the variation.
Well, it might work in a disciplining way, because if you pay a huge amount for a takeover and then you come with very small estimates of synergies, then obviously the investors are going to say, what the hell did you do?
Yeah, but it depends on your length of the return on investment. If you have in mind a return on investment of 5 years, but you will disclose 10 years return on investment, maybe.
But even then, if you say, well, I'm going to earn it back in 20 years, and that's why I paid $10 billion,
okay.
A lot of investors are going to say, are you out of your mind?
Okay, now the other problem there is that the requirement to disclose forward-looking data. This is forward-looking data, and I'm not sure it will be something that will be capable of being audited.
Well, it is forward-looking, but it's forward-looking justify the present, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's Hans's point, that when you
decide to pay a certain amount for an acquisition, this would be just justifying how you got to that amount. And you get to that amount by doing forward-looking projections. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do, but that's another paper, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Disclosure requirements, so let's talk about that later.
There's actually, in paragraph 12, I did list another two approaches that the paper 18C develops one approach, but in paragraph 12 I also listed two other approaches that we could consider, and the third one on that is looking at the comparing the performance against the assumptions.
Stephen?
So I really like what you're doing, and I would encourage you to develop it further. To use Daryl's analogy, the current system, to my mind, is a FIFO approach. Effectively, when the value of the CGU declines, you assume, firstly, it's the inherent goodwill that's disappearing, then it's only much later that the purchase goodwill gets in. So you've proposed a LIFO-type approach. I think that's going to be very controversial because of the problem of you're assuming that the buffer sort of stays the same, but clearly the buffer is going to decline as well as the purchase goodwill. So I think you should look also at an average cost approach and then apportion the impairment between the two. That might be another way of doing it. Also, there's a question of whether the buffer itself should be updated, and is there a way of trying to improve the accuracy of the impairment test by thinking about some sort of updating. Now, that may not be a full purchase price allocation at each reporting date, but there may be other ways in which that can be done. I think it's likely to be very controversial. I think some field testing, I think, would be necessary with all of this. I don't see it as essentially a day one test, so I think the day zero name should be changed, because I'm not sure that's really the main benefit of it. The real benefit is later on. So I think this is something that very much should be worked on further, and it would be potentially a big step forward, I think, in impairment testing.
Mary?
Couple of things. One is on the approach that has been developed in this paper, Michelle, it seems that to me one of the cost-benefit considerations is going to be how significant the effort is to do the additional step in 12B. And so in terms of any further work like the staff to do, I'm not opposed to Steve's idea of field testing, but I think a first kind of screening question is to get information about how easy or hard that 12B calculation is. Because it says, you know, using sorry, not 12B, 12A, sorry, 12A, to make a separate calculation for purposes of identifying the buffer at the date the CGU, you know, the CGU is mud, is that we have to do the calculation anyway and it's easy to input additional assumptions, or is it a lot of the effort goes into determining what the assumptions are so that it's that's a very significant additional burden. When I look at 12C, I think it would be very challenging to mandate that as a as a regular test you must do a quantification. But I think the discussion that's in 12C is useful in terms of thinking about what is an indicator that goodwill may be impaired, and I don't know that I'd want to lose some of the lose all the thought process here. I think Chung Wu had a very good warning that some of the feedback we're getting about goodwill and goodwill impairment is the complexity of all of this, and in even just 12A adds to rather than reduces the complexity. I think his suggestion of should we look instead at eliminating value in use is not just it's not just a simplification, that would be a major conceptual change, but I do take his warning, and I think we should bear it in mind that it's the over it's the complexity of the overall calculation that's raising some problems in practice.
Yeah.
Thank you. I really appreciate this paper. I think this is a kind of remarkable conceptual progress in this standard. Actually, in the previous discussion, we say the goodwill has kind of six components, and we never discussed the pre-existing internally generated goodwill. So you spotted it. So this is remarkable progress. Yeah. And however, question is, as Changgu and Mary pointed out, what kind of measurement basis should we give to the pre-existing internally generated goodwill? Because normally, when you create internally generated goodwill, we do not measure it. So therefore, no value. However, once you acquire some companies, no matter what the acquisition is all about, automatically you would end up fair valuing those internally generated goodwill. So what is the proper measurement basis for that internally generated goodwill? So you are proposing use it as a buffer. So if we use it buffer, then it would be reduced based on the other calculation. So a good example is in your paper, page 13, which is about example of cash generating unit of A and B. And if you look at the cash generating unit of A, you calculate that pre-existing internally generated goodwill was 40, which was calculated based on the pre-existing business. However, we use it for the impairment that's only reduced 5, then still 35 remains. And in the case of CGU B, 20 will remain as it is. So then basically, upon the acquisition, we change the measurement basis of pre-existing internally generated goodwill. So we need to discuss conceptually whether this is right or not. If we can calculate it, pre-existing internally generated goodwill accurately. So,
of course we cannot,
but according to this paper, this is based on the presumption that we can calculate what is the fair value of internally generated goodwill. We arrive at it is 40. So, suppose we can calculate it like 40 or 20, then question is, can we keep it as it is, or should we written off on day zero, or shall we consider other things? So such kind of discussion is needed.
The thing is that implicitly it is calculated during the impairment test. Yes.
Yeah, it is calculated.
It is already being calculated, and probably not precisely.
But what Michel is proposing is you have to calculate it at the point of acquisition. Yeah. So that means pre-existing internally generated goodwill existed no matter what you are doing. Even if you didn't purchase anything, it existed. So then what Michel is proposing is you have to calculate it based on current existing business and arrive at the figure like 40 or 20. So then it existed always for every other companies as well. But for other companies, because they haven't made any acquisition, they calculate it as a zero. But all of a sudden, when you acquire something...
Yeah, but it is not being recognized. It's
recognized.
Only used for impairment test.
Yeah, impairment test.
Calculating it for something is what you're saying. Even if it is just for the impairment test, you aren't doing the determination.
Yeah. Because impairment test, we only impair 5, so it is work as a buffer. But in the impairment test, if we use it as a buffer, eventually we calculate it, and it is incorporated in the under the name of goodwill. So question is it goodwill or is it pre-existing internally generated goodwill? That's the point.
I think it would be clearer if I called it something like headroom rather than pre-existing internally generated goodwill.
Yes. It's basically setting a baseline.
Yeah, and comprised of different things.
Yeah. Can I ask a couple of questions?
Well, no, Mauro is first.
Okay. It's just an additional point. I like what others mentioned. I do like the paper particularly because it's a short but very dense paper, I would say, in terms of new ideas. But I do like your idea of exploring the alternative 12A. And in addition to what was already mentioned, I guess I was mostly concentrating when reading in the cost of applying this and in the practicability of doing that. And Steve mentioned the need to do field testing. And this was, I expect you to comment on the field testing aspect. Since you didn't, I'd like to know if the studies provided by the Japanese and IFRAG, they eventually brought something that is somewhat similar to what you are proposing and potentially investigate that further, or, and if they don't, how do you envisage we can do, because I think it will be key, essential to do some field testing here, to really not develop something that will be extremely costly and not practical.
Yes, I think this is a new idea we're developing. Yeah. And my understanding, it hasn't been looked at by others.
Okay. FESB is not looking at this?
No.
No.
We have spoken to them about some staff, they're very interested in this idea and just to see how our discussions progressed on it.
Pat?
Thanks. I am also very keen on you continuing to pursue this idea, and I've of the view that the IAS 36 is broken right now, so we definitely need to do something. My concern with the approach that you've selected here is it continues to use the basic principle in 36, which is to look at the pre-existing CGU of the acquiring company with the new CGU effectively of the acquired company. And so that's one issue. In terms of trying to make an assessment as to whether or not the goodwill that you've acquired is actually, you know, maintaining its value or, in fact, maybe improving in value or deteriorating, I think it's just illogical to try to combine what you already have with what you've acquired. The notion that there are synergies and that they immediately come together, okay, I think is something that can be dispelled pretty easily. I think you can look at what you bought, okay, and the assumptions that went into what you bought independently of your existing CGU. So I think that's one of the inherent theoretical issues in 36. But then the approach that you're suggesting here, I think, is an apples to oranges calculation. Because in making an assessment of goodwill on day one, when you actually measure it, you're comparing the purchase price to the fair value of your identifiable tangible and intangible assets. But when you're trying to come up with your, as you call it, your headroom of your existing CGU, you're performing a different calculation. The carrying amount is not the fair value of identifiable and intangible assets of the existing CGU. It's a mixed measurement model, as we have under GAAP. And you're making an assessment of your recoverable amount. You could use any number of approaches. You could use a multiple approach. You could use a DCF model. You could use, you know, whatever we have, obviously, out there. So I just see that there's inherent inconsistencies in the mechanics right now that will not really make this thing work. But I think you're on the right path in terms of pulling these things apart. That's really the key point here, is disaggregating these assessments. I think Martin raises a lot of valid points, which I'm in the same camp right now. But I actually think if you're going to do this, you need to change the literature to examine what you've acquired independent of what you currently have. And if, in fact, you say immediately it's integrated, then you have to have built into that integration your measurement of your goodwill on day one. So whatever synergies you're going to get from the acquiring company, that's either a cost assumption or a revenue assumption, but it remains an independent calculation separate and apart from the acquiring company. So you can build those assumptions in and keep it independent, in my view. I heard from GPF members here a couple of weeks ago, you know, that this is a non-starter, just impossible. But then you had one honest voice at the table who said, no, this is not a non-starter, this is a very sound approach, continue to pursue it. Okay, and I'm of the view that that individual is on the right path as well. So I think if we continue to kind of work on how the mechanics might work, and as Steve said, you know, do some field testing, I think we can come to something reasonable here. I also subscribe very strongly to what Philippe said, which is I think the literature shouldn't prohibit on day one an adjustment to goodwill. I recognize Martin's point that, you know, you get a fairness opinion, but the fairness opinion speaks to the overall purchase price you're paying, not necessarily the allocation of the purchase price, okay, which goodwill is a function of your allocation. So I don't see an inconsistency there. And I frankly, if I'm sitting in the corner office and I have to write down goodwill on day one, I'd rather do that than at the end of the first or the second quarter where someone's going to say, wait a second, right out of the box, you're saying this deal is lousy. I'd rather take the pain and say
it's not going to happen. No, but more likely, I think it will instill some discipline in the whole process from the very beginning. If management knows I have to take this internally generated goodwill into account at a later stage, perhaps I shouldn't pay as much as I was planning to do.
Because I've heard so many CEOs on calls where they're announcing these deals say, oh, that's just accounting. Don't pay any attention to it.
Well, they're not going to recognize it. Take one more. So.
Philippe? Yeah, I think that stuff in continuing going down this road, which I think is good to look at, should also be careful of assessing any negative impact of this new approach on existing practices. I explain myself. Is there a risk that we create an incentive to not allocate this acquisition to an existing CGU to avoid having to perform the calculation or to avoid having to have a stronger impairment test? So I think we should assess whether the standard is strong enough to resist this negative bias that could be created by this proposal.
Gary, and then
I think actually missed the Global Preparers Forum, but I probably would have been the majority if I was sitting at the table, my old job.
I'll give an update on the meeting before paper 18B.
But I think this still, even if you went to field test just solely this proposal, I mean, you still got the issues, what is and how do you determine a cash generating unit, how do you allocate goodwill, and I think those have to be, if assuming we did field test it, I think those have to be answered first, because that's just going to come right back at you. The defects is the way you define cash generating units. The defects is limitations on what assets and net assets can get allocated. The defects of how do you determine the fair value for something that's not traded? You know, what's your weighted average cost of capital? I think all of that's going to come right back at you if you field tested this in a vacuum. So I don't think even if we wanted to go this route, it's not ready for prime time.
Well, I think the virtue of this proposal is that it lays bare the shortcomings of the current impairment test. So that is something that everybody who says this is a non-starter should answer how to solve that then. I'm not so concerned about your solution to freeze it, because I don't think it naturally needs to decline. Internally generated goodwill can be maintained by current expenditures. I think if you go ahead with this proposal, shouldn't focus on this day one issue by recognizing impairment at the very beginning. I don't think in practice that will happen. I think if it has an impact, it will lead to more discipline in terms of how much you are prepared to pay. So that would be another advantage of this model. My major concern is that whereas the current impairment test is already a highly theoretical exercise, we're taking this very much more further into subjective territory, and the fact that there are costs involved. But I think it's an idea that's worthwhile pursuing, but perhaps we need to take, we need to have a full picture of where, what else we could do before we decide that we are going to pursue it or not. And perhaps that just the disclosure requirements can do a lot already.
Well, I also listed two other approaches that we could consider in paragraph 12b and 12c. I didn't know if there was any appetite around the table.
Explain again.
In paragraph B, it was first, the paragraph 12b was looking at trying to quantify any overpayment. So it's probably removing the restriction from not allowing overpayment to be written off at day one. In C, it would be measuring the goodwill on a standalone basis against the assumptions that gave rise to it at acquisition. So I'd envisage this would require a comparison of the actual performance of the acquisition against the key performance targets. So it's very much linked to the disclosure paper, but perhaps a more detailed
calculation. That might be better. And then you justify that by the fact that currently you are able to use assets that are not recognized for the impairment test, and this would remove that in another way. Sue?
On the, I prefer 12A, and I think it's an interesting idea, so I think it's worth pursuing. The overpayment one, I don't really like the others much, and the overpayment one, I worry a little bit, even though I think we're probably right, the comments that people have made about how likely is it that any CEO is going to admit there's been overpayment, I agree with that, but when we talk about goodwill more generally, we raise concerns about the moral hazard of writing off goodwill on day one, because then you're not so accountable for the acquisition over time. And given the subjectivity of calculating these overpayment amounts, as already reflected in the basis to IFRS 3, I wonder about introducing some sort of moral hazard problem of a similar nature if we start to allow people to come up with an overpayment calculation that can be immediately expensed. I sort of feel like we might be putting our toe into that water.
I mean, in the past, you could, in this country, you could write off immediately.
All goodwill, yeah.
All of them. Yeah, all of it, without admitting that it was an overpayment. That's very different from, in this case,
I agree. I just worry that we're heading and putting our toe in the water on a very subjective number, so I'd still be concerned. I prefer 12.
They're not going to do it.
But what is the fair value on day one? The transaction between two willing parties, or is it a subjective calculation which some accounting is doing in the back office and coming then with an overpayment? I'm sorry.
I don't understand why, after 3 months, when you do the first quarterly closing, you have to do an impairment test and recognize any overpayment, and you cannot do it 3 months before at the time of the acquisition.
Because I think the nice thing about what Michelle's developed here, or what the staff have developed in this paper, is you don't have to put an overpayment label on it. It's a calculation that doesn't require you to make this distinction between something that's technically an overpayment and something else. And I think that's what's elegant about this. But I think it helps the problem without labelling it, and help it without requiring you to actually identify it as an overpayment.
That's the calculation over 3 months will not change that much, that you sell or have to wait 3 months.
Change enormously. Price of oil changes.
It can, but I mean, the economics will not change enormously over 3 months.
How can you say it is fair value? How can you then say it is a fair value? How we recognize the acquisition? This is not the fair value. If you have a day one impairment, is not fair value.
If at the end of 3 months, doing what we require, you have to recognize an impairment, I don't think that doing that 3 months before at the time of the acquisition will lead you to a different result. In most cases, it will be the same.
That will not happen.
Well, unless there has, something has changed.
I share some of many of Sue's concerns about 12B and the moral hazard, because Pat, you know, thinking about, I think it was Pat's comment about been on calls and people say, well, that's just an accounting write-off. I could see, you know, the deal is transformative, useful, etc. There's an accounting convention that requires us to write off a piece, you know, the price on day one. Don't worry, that's a non-cash item. I actually am concerned, because I think B is sufficiently subjective that it could become almost elective, in the maybe rare circumstances where somebody wants to get rid of it, and maybe it wouldn't be so rare if you can isolate it as an accounting convention. So some concerns around that. On C, I think I would just be quite hesitant, not because of the thinking. I think the thinking is great in terms of pointing out the discipline that should be involved in assessing the recoverability of goodwill, but I think requiring this calculation to be made at every reporting, you know, at least annually or on whatever basis we require goodwill calculation to be made in the future if we change that, it just would multiply enormously the complexity of the calculation. And so that's back to the, you know, are we trying to reduce the cost
from financial assets, though? The cost that you're imposing on banks to make an assessment of their assets.
And that was a long and thoughtful consultation process about whether those costs justified the outcome. I think it isn't every incremental improvement, but we're trying to respond to different concerns from both sides, both payers and users, about the complexity of the calculation and the subjectivity. And I'm just concerned about requiring C as opposed to picking up some of the thinking in terms of here are things that you should be considering in triggers and assessment of recoverability.
Greg Wall?
Several points. Now, basically, I still prefer, you know, the amortization approach, and a few doubts about any efforts. But I would not be against, you know, further explorations. I have two questions. Firstly, if you day one, you know, find the impairment, where should goes amount?
Sure.
P&L. Why not?
P&L, yes. Then the empirical finding is day two, people is not willing to recognize. How we can change the momentum, you know?
With the IASB.
Pardon? I feel doubt. This is why I feel doubt, you know. In the past, why people, you know, are willing to do so is because based on traditional models against, you know, the equity, and people immediately feel it's a bad choice. But, you know, to recognize expense day one, I feel doubt it will work. One thing I want to ask, you know, whether we plan to discuss with SF members this month or next month?
Discuss with who, sorry?
SF.
ASAP.
All right. We're not sure. We haven't got a time slot for this meeting.
Yeah, I think we can have some kind of, you know, test worker people's preliminary views on this. You know, this is why I say I'm not.
I think we should develop it further first.
Hans, can I just make an observation? You say it'll never happen, right? The day one write-off that he's talking about. But let's say a deal is announced and a purchase price is agreed on October 1st, and the deal closes December 31st.
Okay.
To Stephen's point, if the deal was in the E&P, the energy and productive, extractive industry area, and the price of oil goes from 50 to 25 in that period of time, I could have a change in my purchase price allocation that might warrant a write-down of my goodwill. The fair value was determined, okay, between two willing parties on a given day.
Oh, that's really good. There was actually a situation like that.
But have you ever participated in the acquisition?
Yeah.
Yes,
how
I have.
How that is done.
Yeah, I have.
And it is not, man. If then,
they couldn't
work
up the goodwill.
If some planning, if some accountants are sitting and doing calculations which would demonstrate an overpayment at closing.
Yeah.
Do you think that will ever happen?
It happened during the financial
crisis.
Never,
ever. Never, ever.
In 06 and 07, I saw it, Martin.
Can I ask a further question?
No.
Very
Daryl.
Simple.
No, no, we have. Daryl.
So I was about to say the opposite to what Martin's just said. I think there are certainly, I've seen circumstances where the timeline that Pat has just referred to is relevant. So the date at which you determine the price and the date on which transfer happens. The second element which I think might give rise to that initial loss would be an element where having actually got control of the underlying entity and have had insight into its operations, you discover information post the date of acquisition, but that was relevant at the date of acquisition. Yeah,
but isn't this the buffer, but sorry, what to say, this buffer calculation would only make sense not at closing, but at when the deal price is announced, it's made, because otherwise it will not make sense. And this timing difference has to take into account then.
My point was going to be, I think just in the context of what you're going to explore, I fully appreciate what Sue and Mary's concerns are. But I think that by specifically closing the door, and we can decide at which date that door should be not closed or should be opened, I think by specifically closing that door, sometimes we do lose information that is relevant. And it might be an oil price drop between the date that I signed and the date that it might be a regulatory change between the date that I price determined and the date the transfer happened. But the reality is there are occasions when you can point to something and say, oh heck, this wasn't what we thought was going to happen. And that would then suggest, as things stand at the moment, you would wait and you would explain that as part of your first impairment test, where in fact it was something that related not to the period between, but the period at. And I just think we need to think about, I understand the moral hazard issues, but I think we just need to be comfortable that we're not losing something because we're worried about moral hazard.
Amaro?
It's very quick, because I went back and read the basis for conclusion on IFRS 3 when it comes to overpayment. It's only one paragraph. And I read the paragraph twice. And if we are going to revise the basis for the treatment of overpayment, I think it's a project that will take us quite some time to reach an agreement, because it would be very, very difficult to change the thinking of the board considering this. I totally agree with Martin. I mean, of course, there are in such a volatile and unstable economic environment, many things can change between the date of the agreed price and the transfer of the consideration. But this is different stuff. And then this is aligned with Dara.
Mary?
I'll be the technical footnote to this discussion, which is the IFRS 3 says you make the determination of goodwill at the acquisition date.
Yes, exactly.
And there was a long, drawn-out history of, is it the day you agreed the date, or is the transaction, or is the date you completed, and the standard landed, the boards landed, I think after a fair amount of debate, on the day you obtain control, normally the day you complete. So going back and looking at this versus the agreement date would open a whole other area of the standard. And it isn't that we shouldn't ever do that, but I think we should be aware that that isn't a tweak or just a different reference point. It would be running up against one of the important issues in this date. And, in terms of the whole moral hazard thing, I think there's a difference between saying you identify an overpayment as part of the transaction accounting and write it off versus because of changes in circumstances, we paid X, which included this amount for goodwill, and circumstances have changed so rapidly that we have an almost immediate impairment of that goodwill. And that's kind of Philippe's point about 3 months versus acquisition date.
But I think the way you've just explained it is essentially what I think I was saying, which is that the date on which you determine the goodwill is the acquisition date, the later of the dates.
The date on which you determine the price is an earlier date.
Maybe an earlier date. It may be flexible. It may not.
But so what you Darryl's quite right. often see, what you quite often see exactly. in different environments, and I've seen it in for example, we've seen it recently in South Africa. Between the date on which the price was determined,
yeah,
the approving
right.
authorities
yeah.
said, "We approve this transaction, but will not allow you the retrenchments that were part of your determination
yeah.
of price." So there is a entity or transaction-specific thing that resulted in the transaction price, as Martin said, that was determined by market forces no longer being valid
mm-hmm.
because something had changed between those two dates. And I fully understand the moral hazard, and I think we need to be aware of the moral
yeah.
hazard, but it seems like we're losing a really important
but
piece
but
of
so
information.
So is the fear of moral hazard that companies will start impairing?
Will start impairing too early because that saves them being accountable for how much they've paid later.
It's basically saying I've made a bad decision by acquiring this company.
Where's
the moral hazard?
And I was, by the way, putting up the flag, literally, that the description that you just offered of the changes in circumstances includes an aspect of saying, you know, exploring what is the appropriate valuation date. And that, I think,
yeah.
just runs into the buzzsaw of the
yeah.
decision here.
I don't think this discussion should focus so much on that day one, because that's not the main element.
Yeah. Can I just comment on that change in the price that it might occur between
changing the value
or change the value between agreement date and date of control acquisition date might then lead the company to think, well, I've ended up having to pay more than I would have liked to have paid based on my original basis of calculation. That in itself doesn't necessarily automatically lead to an overpayment or an impairment as such. And what we're trying to do here with this model is to just take out from the impairment testing the effect of pre-existing goodwill that might have to shelter potential impairments.
That's
12A.
I think it's 12A.
Indeed.
We don't
yes.
12B at the moment.
Okay. Well, maybe not 12B. We're talking about something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Philippe.
Just quickly.
I think we're talking about situations where there is a possibility of overpayment. If there was not a possibility of overpayment, we would not be having this discussion, right?
No.
So whether it is accounted for on day one or on day two is another issue. But
no.
So I like the indicators which are provided in paragraph 12b, the five of indicators of a possible situation or more likely situation of overpayments. In combination, if you have two or three of those cumulative indicators, you are probably in a situation where there is a bigger risk of having had an overpayment. So I think it's useful to include them as a warning that when you meet one or several of those criteria, you have to better be careful about assessing the risk of an overpayment, more careful than otherwise. So I think it could be, and also we have to think that maybe a CEO or CFO will never recognize having overpaid, but there are auditors and there is a board of directors and there is an audit committee on top of that. And if corporate governance works as it should be, maybe there will be some questions from the audit committee. And if we had indicators here, maybe warning the people in charge of oversight that in those situations better ask some questions, that could be helpful, I think.
Martin?
One sentence to that, but I think the fairness opinion are done, especially for the audit committees on corporate governance, because I think they are responsible that they oversight that the right price is paid. But I only can comment. Second, I want to say, man, we discussing this impairment on day one, but the post-implementation reviews, I think, that was focusing what are the problems, and I think that was not identified as one of the main problems was
yeah.
the standard. And I think we should not focus our discussion now on impairments
yeah,
on day
exactly.
one.
Exactly, that's what I'm trying to say all the time.
about
the essence of 12C is not the day one, it's what's happening afterwards.
Fairness opinions take place only when there is an exchange of shares, not when you buy cash or with
no,
debt.
No, it's also done also in transactions where you pay cash.
Well,
because it is really can, if you currently now bought.
Not in my experience.
In my experience, it is also done for.
Yeah, when you have an exchange of shares, then an independent expert must say whether the parity for the exchange is correct, is fair, not when you pay cash.
If you are a CEO of a company, with okay, all guys, this lawsuit.
Offline. Gary?
Okay, I'll make this quick, because I know we're running. I think the deal, the M&A work I was involved with, both buying and selling, typically when a material piece of the transaction was very volatile, very often, maybe not all the time, Pat, but you'll put in boundaries, you know, the price of oil between 40 and 50, or
sometimes,
all these conditions precedent the closing, or you make an adjustment, you know, the closing price driven by form. The same thing, if I'm paying with shares, I commit my shares worth £100 or whatever.
But in a bidding situation, sometimes you don't have that luxury.
Well, it depends, but I'm just saying it does not, you would have gotten the impression it didn't exist at all. In fact, it's, I think it's very common. And then two, I think Michael made my other point, the fact that you might pay more than ideally you wanted to doesn't mean you got an impairment. In fact, you might even, if need be, even pay even more than you end up closing at because you needed the deal, you wanted the deal, even if it's not for ROI.
We're not saying that it is. Well, we're asking for is a consideration for that issue in the impairment test.
But the point is, you can it can even have a worse deal and doesn't necessarily automatically be gapped to get an impairment. That's all. Right. You know, the fact that paid more, you might even paid even more still to close the account.
Right.
It's been an interesting discussion. IFRS 3 was a really big step forward, but it's also highly theoretical and based on the assumption that you can identify and value all the assets that you've bought, and then the bit left over is goodwill. And then it's also based on the premise that later on you can have a look for that bit of goodwill and try and work out whether it's still worth what you estimated its value to be at the time you took over. You shouldn't say that that's what you paid for. It's the bit left over. And I'm in favour of pursuing this a bit further, but we're getting even more theoretical in that we're assuming, I think, that we can measure the goodwill in the bit we've already got. Now, you know, that's a different type of goodwill from the goodwill that's the bit left over when you do the acquisition. And then, so in theory, it could all be glamorous. In practice, I'm a bit with Martin that trying to implement this in practice would be really difficult.
But would you leave IAS 36 the way it is?
Well, that's why I'm in favour of continuing to pursue this to see if there's a way it can be done, because I don't have any other brilliant ideas
but there are
on
three,
how to fix the impairment.
There are three proposals here that are all very different.
Yeah.
Very different, and we've gone all over the place in this discussion.
Yeah. Well, but we were focusing on 12A, which is what Nisha wanted us to do in this paper.
Yeah.
12B, I don't think, unless the indicators are useful in some circumstances, I don't think it's got a lot of legs. And the key, we need a debate, and I think it comes in paper 18B, on whether this reporting of key performance ideas is a good idea or not. Mm. We still need to talk about that, but I'm really focusing on 12A.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I'd agree with Ian. Why I like the approach that you've suggested developing is because you don't have to identify the specific overpayment bit. The thing I was going to say, just sort of consistent with what Ian's saying, is the basis in IFRS 3 already acknowledges the fact the board knew that this was a bit of a squishy number.
Yeah.
And they concluded that in practice it would not be possible to identify and reliably measure overpayment at the acquisition date. I haven't heard any new evidence to suggest it's got any easier or more precise.
But here we go again with the acquisition date, which I think that's not the... Or is that the most important?
If we start focusing on overpayment, then yes.
12B
but
is about.
I think the other approach is broader. I think that's why I like Michelle's approach.
12A.
Yeah.
But 12A is it's about the impairment.
Correct.
That is post acquisition.
That's good.
Yeah.
It's the other stuff I don't
understand. To try to force them to recognize overpayment that they want is a hopeless exercise.
12B is the one that is acquisition date.
That's why there's more support to 12A.
Yeah. Well, so can we then just wish you success and ask? I think we all know what the pitfalls are. We go to discuss disclosure now, which I think may be more promising.
Can I just ask one thing, Michelle? In the further developing this, one thing I would be interested to see is how the mechanics would actually work if you had more than one acquisition.
Yeah.
In the CGU, because I think then it might start to get a little bit trickier. And I think we need to at least have thought that through.
So we will not ask you to look at 12B, right?
No, 12C.
Martin, happy? Yeah?
And
he doesn't want 12A. 12A either, yeah. Well, we and everybody is, you know, cautious about 12A, but thinks it might be worth pursuing.
Sorry.
And I think we're going to talk about disclosures right now.
Well, I think 12C would probably build on the disclosures, because people don't like the disclosures.
Yeah. I might be convinced of this, but...
Okay, moving on to paper 18B. Paper 18B looks at ways we might want to consider to make the disclosures about goodwill and impairment more effective. The staff are recommending that we consider developing further disclosures D1, D2 and D3 as part of this project. These disclosures are explain why a premium was paid, together with identifying the key performance targets supporting the price paid. Providing a basic comparison of actual performance against the key performance targets for, say, a few years following the acquisition, and also providing a breakdown of goodwill by past acquisition. Now, the staff would expect the disclosures to be driven as much as possible by management's own assessment and performance monitoring, rather than being a newly prescribed analysis. However, we have suggested as a first step we should talk to preparers to see what they're currently doing and do some field testing. Earlier this month, we discussed the disclosures D1 and D2 at the Global Preparers Forum. Nearly all the GPF members expressed some concerns about preparing the disclosures. However, as Pat mentioned, one member agreed that something definitely should be done in the area because entities are not currently monitoring whether an acquisition is successful. And that member encouraged the staff to continue to pursue the proposals and keep asking companies how they track acquisitions have been successful. The main concerns expressed by GPF members about disclosing the key performance targets supporting the purchase price were, firstly, it would require disclosure of sensitive information. For example, it would disclose a company's internal metrics on what a company is willing to pay in an acquisition, and so it may affect their situation in future acquisitions. And also that it may be difficult to make key targets measurable and auditable. For example, some of the key targets supporting the purchase price may be factors that it's difficult to measure, such as acquisition of human competencies. The main concerns expressed by GPF members about disclosing a basic comparison of actual performance against the key performance targets were, firstly, often the acquiree is integrated quite quickly into the acquirer's business, and so it's difficult to determine going forward what relates to the acquisition and what relates to the existing business. For example, it's difficult to identify which cost savings or increases in revenue are a result of the acquisition or would have been generated anyway. Also, there was concern that often the targets that are anticipated are not met, but this does not mean that the acquisition is not successful, because often changes are made to the plans after the acquisition has been made in order to maximise the value of the business, and also in response to other factors such as changes in the economy. And also other positive outcomes may come from the acquisition that were not previously expected. And there are also concerns that acquisitions of smaller companies would be very difficult to track, as often they're part of a very big operation. And several members noted that this kind of monitoring of the subsequent performance of an acquisition is not being performed at the moment, unless acquisitions are very significant or isolated from the rest of the acquirer's business. So maybe we can have a discussion about which disclosures the board members would like the staff to consider further.
Gary?
Michelle, as you know, I actually support more disclosures, and I think there's two different questions in here in terms of just the performance results. There's one that's disclosure of actual, what was your incrementality to the acquiring company, and then there's a comparison against, you know, the performance targets set out in the purchase price or something like that. I think the first one just here's the actuals. They are what they are. Or again, you might debate over what the actuals are, but assume it's some measure of incrementality, you know, to the group, is a lot easier to do and less contentious than it would be, what are your performance targets? Now, granted, if you're having a selling debt or shares to the public, there's a very good chance you've had to disclose, you know, some, what are your expectations to get the shareholder vote in favor of the acquisition. But most acquisitions don't go that route. They're either private placements or it's only the selling company that needs, you know, the shareholder vote, not the buying company. So it's got its place, but it's limited. I do think it's, if you're going to field test, and I would encourage it, I think you really need to focus on, really material acquisitions that are very likely to get high-level attention on a going-forward basis. The little day-to-day stuff probably does get lost. But I think there's certainly enough high-visible acquisitions that there's a good universe, you know, that can be studied in it. I philosophically support whatever reservations, again, about making a comparison against the targets that you set. If you disclose the incrementality, you already know how much was paid for the company. You can, you know, an analyst could do a rough ROI calculation. And the other thing is, by default, the number that's not the incremental is the beginning business. And so it's sort of hard to, you know, mask one from the other. If you make the acquisition look too good, the existing business that bought it, you know, was diminished, you know, assuming there's a little bit of a gamesmanship or at least some flexibility about how to allocate it. And I think you're right, is how do you measure the incrementality? You can buy somebody that's synergistic for you, and you both go to joint go-to-market. Well, is neither one of you could get the new business on your own, but together you can. So does that count towards the acquisition, or does it count towards the, you know, organic growth for the buying company? Those are, I think, issues that you can flesh out. How might you do it? At the end, though, I think it's going to be like an IFRS 8. What does the CEO or the top of the house look at to evaluate performance? I think it's going to get problematic very quickly other than that approach.
Philippe?
Thank you. I think this order D3 is a very minimum. I think that's starting point, quite the minimum. I find it quite difficult when I look at a set of financial statements. I see billions amounts of goodwill on those balance sheets. I know what happened in the current year. I know what happened in the prior year because I have 2 years. But a lot dates back to earlier years, and I have to go back and look at financial statements and dig out those information. I find it quite hard. And so I think it's a minimum. Every material amount of goodwill which is still there on the balance sheet as of the reporting date should be identified. I think that will be quite helpful. By the way, the analyst liked the idea, I think. Regarding D1 and D2, I think they go together. I think you cannot ask people to explain why there was a premium and not ask them to give the subsequent information, how this materialized or not. So I think it will be not effective to say, or just announce that you have a premium because you expected this. It begs so much questions afterwards, what happened. And by the way, I think that when the acquisition takes place, if material, the entity will provide the market with a lot of information about why the acquisition is taking place in order just to protect their market price, the share price. At that time, if they don't give the information, share price will fall because markets do not like acquisitions most of the time. So they have to justify the acquisition, and I don't see why it should not be carried over to the financial statements themselves. Because it is provided, it is done, it is provided. So I think it will be beneficial to have this information be included in the disclosures. But I think that it goes with some subsequent information because it will be kind of teasing people and not giving the answer.
Thank you. I agree with the basic trend for the staff is proposing. And basically D1, D2, D3 is fine. However, I think we have two challenges. One challenge is how shall we consolidate with current requirements? We already have paragraph B64, which is very precise and the voluminous disclosure requirement. And this requirement is possible when you have only one acquisition or one or two acquisition a year. But suppose if you have 100 acquisition, it's already impossible. And actually, lots of constituents are struggling with these disclosures. And I think there might be some overlap between this requirement and the requirement you are proposing. And on top of that, I'm wondering what is the difference between the requirement which we have in IS 36. IS 36 will require the comparison of the assumption. And actually, it is when the impairment test is going around. So fundamental, I understand there is a fundamental difference. But again, some people pointed out compliance of disclosure of IS 36 is already difficult. So we have to do this some kind of scrap and build and make it much concise and straightforward. That is what we should do. And the second point is, how do we challenge the information about the business sensitiveness? Actually, many GPF members pointed out, and basically they agree that they need to disclose something to the investors, and they are quite aware that they are using investors' money and a huge amount of investors' money, and they think they have to provide good information so that the investor can judge whether or not my acquisition is going well or not. However, because of the information sensitiveness, they are quite reluctant to disclose it as it is, because the competitor would see it. They would be happy to provide those information to investors only. For example, in the IR private investor relationship conversation, but not in the general purpose financial statement. That is the challenge we need to solve. So with these two challenges, I agree with the direction of the staff proposing.
Mary?
I think the staff has, I agree with the staff's recommendations about which items to focus on. A couple of other thoughts that I wanted to throw into the mix were, one, When I try to compare the wording of the current requirement, which you quote in the paper, with the in paragraph 11, with the proposed new disclosure requirements, at one level they're just not that different, and so to me there is perhaps quite a significant compliance issue here, and sometimes tweaking the words might help in terms of getting people to look freshly at it, et cetera, and having a debate around it. But I think we'd want to explain if we saw really substantive differences. And so I think a lot of what we're trying to do is improve the effectiveness of the disclosure requirements. And, a very different approach, and this could be a very bad idea, is this an area like with materiality where we want to look at some kind of practice statement in terms of thinking about considerations? Because one of the things that strikes me through here is I think we're trying to send the message that you have to provide disclosures of information that supports your judgment, your estimate, your assertion that this amount is continues to be recoverable, rather than nothing has hit me over the head that says it's impaired. And to try and get people focused on the if it's a very large number, what have you done? What estimates and judgments have you made? Think about the generic requirement to disclose significant judgments and estimates. Point to that as a consideration that might apply if it is significant to the financial statements. So I'm supportive of you exploring things, and I think also this notion of the breakdown of goodwill by acquisition, there are some problems associated with that, including if you have several acquisitions in the same CGU and you have an impairment, how do you allocate that impairment? But if you have to at some point say, here's a table and I don't know which goodwill I impaired, does that maybe tell you something? And in terms of what I'd ask you to look at in terms of the potential disclosures, I think one is, would users find it useful if the preparer says, because I've integrated this acquisition, my post-acquisition metrics are of the combined business, Gary's example of selling together, going together we can sell things. Well, what if the disclosures they provided were not strictly about the acquisition, which may not exist anymore in that shape, but would it be helpful or not to get information about the combined operation metrics? That's one other thing to look at. As I said, I think a breakdown of goodwill where you have to say, I don't know what I impaired may have a bit of a credibility challenge. And I don't know if for tax purposes they have to track it, but it may be that for tax purposes they just don't allocate any of the impairment because that may be a financial reporting only construct. But in some jurisdictions you probably have to reconcile your financial reporting to your tax returns. In which case they may have to do some kind of allocation for tax purposes, so that might be some kind of hook.
Amaro.
Thanks, Sas. Michelle, reading the proposals, the six points that you made, in going straight to your question about what do we prefer. I think Kaka brought a very important issue for us to consider, the issue of the balance between what is proprietary information or sensitive for in terms of relationship with competitors. And of course, I think we'll be thinking about that, especially because I do like particularly what is in D1 and D2. I've been hearing quite consistently from investors in general that they do not have enough information about how successful acquisitions are in the future, or at least in the near future. They understand there's some synergy in the short and medium term, but they don't have enough information. As Mary, in reading IFRS 3, requirement in terms of B64E, well, I personally think what you are aiming to require is already within the words here. And my view is that, well, it is within the words, but it's not being provided. So the objective would be mostly to improve or streamlining and provide more details in D1 and D2. So I think D1 and D2 are in the right direction. The only difference between them is obviously in D2, the comparison. I think this would be quite challenging. And for these two, I agree with you, it do need some field testing, or what we call field testing discussion with GPF and others. And of course, would be interesting. I do know the IFRAG or ESMA paper has identified some issues about disclosure in this, but I do think if we could identify if someone in some way is providing this sort of information, how they are providing and why they are providing and others are not, are they concerned about the competitors or not, or until which point that they are going in terms of providing information that is useful to investors. Well, D3, I agree with Philippe, it's the starting point. They all might have this, at least this is the basic of the acquisition. So it wouldn't be, I wouldn't be concerned about cost, but I do think here this could be included in what if we land in D1 or either D2, this could be included as an additional information. In terms of D4, I agree with you. I still think D1 and D2 are superior. Here, I think there are loads of potentially boilerplate information. So if we are successful in D1 and D2, it might not even be necessary to explore this further because we'll have the information over there. The D5 about the payback period, I think it's we shouldn't pursue this. We would need a clear definition of what we understand by payback. And I still going back to D1 and D2, I expect this some sort of information that is understood by some as the recoverability of the price paid or the benefits of the acquisition in terms of synergy, whatever, be included in D1 and D2. And D6, I think it's expected to have a look in what IS36 is requiring right now and see what can be improved in terms of providing the right information.
Stephen.
So I'm perhaps going to be non-consensus here. I would do D3, D4, and D6, and I wouldn't do the others. D1 and D2, I think I question whether this is appropriate within the financial statements. I don't dispute the fact that this is part of good financial reporting, and it should definitely appear in the management commentary, but I'm not sure it's a financial statement item. In fact, if you look at management commentary and our paper on that, paragraph 37 essentially already covers this. My suggestion would be to, if we're going to do anything, write a new section for the management commentary paper and add something in there. I mean, I question what's so special about an acquisition. Why don't we have the same disclosures on capital expenditure and starting up a new business internally? Why don't we have the same disclosures on marketing programs or R&D programs? What's so special about acquisitions? I understand the desire for investors to have better information, but is it really a financial reporting issue? Can we perhaps give the non-monetary guidance and management commentary? Can we work with regulators to try and improve the quality of financial reporting overall? I also feel that for D1 and D2, if we do it and put it in the financial statements, we're more likely to get boilerplate rather than good quality information out of it. D3, I would strongly support. I would go further. I would have goodwill by segment. I would have people identify CGUs, maybe even have goodwill by CGU. I would have the historical record of when and what acquisitions you've done. I would keep information about gross goodwill and the impairment amount offset against that, rather than simply get rid of the gross amount and just then report a net figure. And I would keep that as a sort of a separate schedule in the financial statement so people can see this historical record of exactly what's been bought and when. I would do D4 because I think it is important to not just justify an impairment, but also justify a non-impairment. I'm sure there are ways we could do that. I don't think D5 is operational. I think payback period is a very vague term, and I just wouldn't do that. And yes, I would try and look at existing disclosures and therefore improve D6.
Sue?
I'm partly responding to Mary's comment about why is B64E sort of not achieving what we might have hoped when it was written. And I wonder whether by focusing on that, we might be able to indirectly get some of the types of information that we're trying to get through D1 and D2. Because if I look at IFRS 3, I wonder if one of the problems is that it's based on an objective, which is one of the very sort of old-style generic types of disclosure objectives we use, which we talk about provide information that enables users of financial statements to evaluate the nature and financial effect of the business combination. And that's sort of the context of all of the more specific stuff. If it was more clear what we wanted users to be able to understand, so for example, what was management thinking about that justified the amount paid, what were the drivers, and also then linked into, you know, a bit more of a forward look of, not forward look, but over time made you provide information about did you sort of get what you thought you were going to buy, and also linked into some of the key indicators that might help understand impairment. So if we made it more linked to what is it that users are trying to understand, I wonder whether, without being too prescriptive about what the disclosures might look like, we might get a better outcome for what we were already shooting for without changing anything too dramatically. and by if we could draft it in a more objective-based way, better objectives. Also, maybe we could help with this commercial sensitivity point, because then people would have a little bit more flexibility about how they went about meeting it, and they could, in that doing that, sort of balance what they felt was possible to disclose that would still be consistent with the objectives.
Gary?
Yeah, quickly. On D3, I think that's generally doable. I do appreciate if you got goodwill going back 50 or 60 years, maybe there's some practical point you can't go back before, but certainly you can cut it in prospectively. You know, I do agree with Stephen, by segment it would be the right way to do it. On D1 or D2, I do think we do run the risk of boilerplate, but if you go out and field test these questions, I think we got to be careful when we say paid a premium. Do we mean an overpayment? Do you mean there was goodwill? Do you mean something else? Because when we talked earlier, I don't think anyone's going to admit an overpayment. You know, things might not work out right over time, but on day one or the first year or two, it's not likely. If you want to say, why did you have goodwill? I think you're going to get a lot of boilerplate answers. Including which would be, you know, acquisitions are valued on market value or discounted cash flow, which is a different discipline from accounting. And the problem is there's goodwill as a premium because limitations the accounting, not from the negotiations that resulted in the purchase price. So I think you'd be careful how you articulate paid a premium, because if you paid fair value, by definition, you didn't pay a premium. You paid an amount you didn't allocate for accounting purposes. Just be sort of careful how you're articulating.
Martin?
Yeah. Well, I think D1 and D2 is all, D1 is already there, because many acquisitions you have a specific press conference, analyst presentation, where this kind of targets are really announced. For D2, I'm with Stephen, because when I think that is a kind of MD&A stuff, which should go in the management discussion to explain regarding what is the performance towards targets which I have announced. That is not so much with financial statements. And for D3, I agree with Gary that it's doable. Mine with the problem which Mary said, I don't know how to allocate impairments then, which I have made men under the cash generating unit to individual acquisitions. But I would question really what is the information value on that. And to know what is kind of existing goodwill from companies that have 50 acquisitions, to allocate some goodwill to that acquisition 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't see that. But there is a lot of maybe people, I don't know, for press articles that still have acquisitions and from the old acquisition 20 years ago. But what is really for analysts who are taking investment decisions, why do analysts or users have to know breakdown? I think a breakdown of goodwill by cash generating units, that is meaningful. But by a historical acquisition and the name, I don't see what is the information value about that. I don't see that.
Big Rob?
Last month, you know, Michelle also gave us a skeleton of the basic ideas. I offer my views very similar to what Steve said, you know, particularly related to D2. And firstly, whether it is financial statements and notes or not. And I checked with our proposed ED of a conceptual framework. My understanding is the future information, if related to current measurement of the financial statement, will be part of, otherwise not. And then I go further, as Steve said, whether it can be part of the main commentary. I also feel doubt that exactly what Steve said. If we feel it is useful, why I told Michelle, for major research development, for acquisition of major PPEs, why we should not have similar requirements of disclosure. And of course, also as Steve said, no doubt any information will be useful, additional usefulness. But I personally feel doubt, particularly D2.
So I'm a bit worried that we're giving the staff very little guidance as to how to proceed with this.
because we were a bit all over the place.
May I come back on this? One of my suggestions was exactly to test and seek the information already provided, as Martin mentioned, and to check if D1 as proposed is already available for a number of companies. If we have this as a starting point, we can then field test if adding what is D2 is proposing is really going to provide a valuable information, and if it's possible actually or practicable in terms of costs and benefits. I think this would be something that you could take and explore.
Yeah, but a couple of board members have said that we shouldn't. This is not financial statement stuff. This is management commentary.
I just mean to say we couldn't do it because we have a management commentary document. Yeah.
But then why the PPE and the major research development?
Well, that's also included in management commentary guidance. But there may be a desire to have more specialist, more specific suggestions about how you might go about it or acquisitions.
I think on that point, Hans, we could actually ask staff to go away and think about whether it is or it isn't more management commentary type issue. You know, the point I would throw in to that is that we have a recognized asset, goodwill, and we're trying to describe the kind of information that supports its measurement amount, and that may be what distinguishes it from MD&A. But if you go off and think about it, I mean, I see advantages to the way you've expressed D1, D2 as being more focused on tell us about the transaction rather than getting hung up with the accounting construct of goodwill, because in essence, the way it's written today in paragraph 11 of this paper, quote, it's saying, tell us what are the components that we've told you elsewhere you can't recognize as separate assets. And that maybe is expressed in two accounting speak a word, and I think D1 and D2 is a bit more trying to turn it into the economics. But that may be what causes some people, you know, Steve, to think, oh, that feels more like MD&A. But maybe just go off and look at what, you know, how you describe where the boundary is.
In comparison, maybe as a follow-up of what Marie said, if you had a big amount of capitalized R&D, you recognize R&D as an asset instead of expenses. You would have...
Not R.
D, okay, D, not R. Okay, D. Okay, let's... I'm constructing new generation of aircraft, Boeing, Airbus, and I start capitalizing some D, a big amount. I would provide a lot of information in support of that recognized asset, right, under our current standards. Why not give as much information when it is goodwill?
How much are we providing at the moment on that asset?
Performance of said asset?
We do a lot for capitalized development. We do it. We have to explain all the criteria, technical success criteria, commercial success, viability, etc.
People have disclosure requirements.
They're the same nature.
But that's to support a measurement of cost and to justify not impairing it.
Same thing with goodwill.
The goodwill is a cost. Yeah. Is a
but,
cost.
But this goes a lot further.
The goodwill is a cost that you recognize.
Well, the is not day one.
That's a different issue, but the nature of this amount on the balance sheet has to be supported by information as to whether it is a real asset or not. So I don't see a difference in nature between capitalizing development cost and capitalizing and acquired goodwill. In terms of how much information I need to be satisfied that it is a bona fide asset.
But also, do you maybe just building on what Mary said, if you worked on D1 and D2, putting them in the context of how they link to the measurement type aspects and the impairment type aspects, so that it ties more closely into being an explanation of the numbers you can see in the financial statements, maybe that would help sort of anchor what we're shooting for. Might help Steve a little bit, I'm not asking him now, but and it might just bundle it together slightly better, using some of the ideas you've got in here, but packaging them slightly differently.
And this is growing out of, you know, what we've heard from investors saying they want more information about the success of the business combination, and in particular this goodwill number, which otherwise might look like a, you know, well, it is a sort of a residual difference, and then giving some meaning to, well, you know, how has it performed since then? How has the business performed subsequently?
Yeah. I think that's what Stephen's
question.
For
how long would we require to do this?
Well, our ideas here were that we'd be looking at what management had set as their objectives for achieving synergies.
And I think it's that exactly that bit that raises the, is this in the financial statements or MD&A, because that starts to be about something slightly different to the numbers that are actually being...
But
do we still want them to do this in year 10?
Recognition and measurement.
I think it comes back to how have they justified the
you're still carrying it as an asset.
Yeah.
Only for the impairment.
Huh? Still carrying it as an asset.
Yeah. But I mean,
if it's revenue,
you need to go and repay to go and acquisitions are acquired on a yearly basis. Do you carry this forward for 30 years? if even if the asset is still there. A lot of disclosure.
I think it's probably unlikely that that management would set themselves a sort of a, you know, more than 10-year time horizon any of these.
Yeah. Well, so it would stop at a certain point.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, under principles of disclosure, as long as the older information was readily available, you wouldn't worry about the older stuff because you go back and get it. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like the last couple of years. If you want, you wouldn't put 10 years in. POD would say, as long as it's available, don't worry about it.
Okay. So the staff will further explore these ideas and also look at where, which part of the end statement it would fall.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, 18A, finally.
So moving on to customer relationships. The purpose of agenda paper 18A is to describe an issue discussed by the IFRIC in 2008-2009 on customer relationships acquired in the business combination. At the time, the IFRIC provided some advice, but concluded that the issue should be addressed by the board and the FASB. But the issue was deferred pending feedback from the post-implementation review of IFRS 3. At the February, or at the last meeting, a few board members asked for further information about the issue discussed by IFRIC, and so the staff has brought more information back in this paper. We've also added a staff recommendation, which we based primarily on what we thought the IFRIC intended at the time. However, as this issue was discussed 7 years ago, we may want to reconsider this issue in more detail before making any conclusions. This paper is really intended for education purposes, and the staff aren't asking the board members to make any decisions on the paper today, because we think any decisions about amendments to IFRS 3 should be considered with the FASB first. So do board members think they have enough information about this issue?
Mary?
Michelle, I found this paper both very helpful and very challenging. Helpful because it made me aware of a lot of things I hadn't thought about, and I actually feel like I want to understand better what's going on in this area to be able to discuss it on a more informed basis. So it started the right process. One of the things I thought as I read this was some discomfort with the amount that's being ascribed to customer relationship intangibles. And there are a couple things in here. One is, I'm not sure that I want to pursue something that says we should be thinking about making a distinction between a written and an oral contract, because I think that's inconsistent with the way we've approached contracts elsewhere in IFRS. And so I don't think that's a helpful screening mechanism. Second of all, I think calling the customer relationship contractual because it relates to a past or future potential transaction, which could, I think, in theory include me walking into the Sainsbury's across the street, never giving my name, buying, you know, spending 50p on a pint of milk and walking out. Well, the fact that I got a till receipt doesn't, to me, make that a contractual, it doesn't make the company's ongoing relationship with me, doesn't create that ongoing relationship, and it doesn't make it contractual. It's not that I say there's no value. I think that, especially when the discussion about loyalty programs, I think if I've agreed to give you data about me and allow you to collect further data, even if it's as simple as how much milk do I buy at the Sainsbury's, then the asset that you've acquired is more customer data. It isn't customer relationship, and it isn't the profitability of all future transactions that I might have with you because I got a till receipt once. It's because I've agreed to allow you to collect data about me, I've waived some of my data privacy, or I've given you access to some information, and you can provide a database that you may be able to data mine and provide useful information to other parties without giving them my name. So to me, the idea of a customer relationship intangible, if that's the right name for it, is when you have specific information about me, and I question then whether it's actually there's a different intangible for customer data, and then there's customer list, which might be you have my name and address, and I'm not sure that I would measure either of those based on the present value of future profits from probable, possible, likely future transactions with me. So I'm not trying to get, I support the objective of, you know, that we had originally and that we want to continue to build on of disaggregation. And so thinking about what you bought when you paid for, when you paid X for a transaction. But I have some hesitation about the definition and the amount that we're trying to shove in there, because I think it might give the wrong information about what the asset really is. And it was particularly helpful to have the customer loyalty program in here. And I, you know, when I think about how customer loyalty programs have changed since the time the standard was issued, it really makes me think again, because, you know, 10, 15 years ago it was airlines, basically. And it was encouraging frequency of transactions with them. Now it's supermarkets, many other places, it's both encouraging transactions with them, but also giving them demographic information that they can use for other purposes and maybe sell. Not, you know, call Mary, she does X, but when you think about cookies and trackers and how much what ads you see depend upon what places you've looked, it's a very different kind of asset. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be helpful, although it may be challenging to collect the information, to kind of step back in terms of this, how are we fine-tuning customer relationship intangibles, and should we be distinguishing between contractual and non-contractual, because I think our desire to disaggregate may have us pushing some of the boundaries on things like, well, let's call it contractual because we don't want to get into the whole separable debate, and I find it hard to sustain the characterization of contractual, even though it's in a good purpose. Mm-hmm. So that's some thoughts on the paper. It isn't specifically what additional information do you need, but I guess I'd like to know what the staff would think if you looked at it maybe in terms of these different characterizations of the intangibles you're acquiring.
Yeah. Let's have a think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that point you make about the contractual, non-contractual, I mean, that has for many years been at the core of why this area is very difficult, and the differences of view, and as relayed in the IFRIC discussions many years ago, that because even buying some milk from a shop across the street with cash, that many would say is a contract. The question is there also a relationship there? And that's the thing that we're trying to grab hold of.
And the relationship about the fact that I'm going to buy it frequently from the shop, you know, across the road or, you know, on the corner, to me is more going concern in the location of the business rather than their relationship with me as a customer. And so I think I support the objective of disaggregation. I'm not from the lump that is goodwill, but I want us to think about what it really is and whether we're tying ourselves in knots on the basis that the end justifies the means.
Doc?
Thank you. Actually, I was in the meeting of IFRIC when we discussed this. And I don't know whether you were there. But I think
after my time, thankfully.
Right. Okay. Actually, what we were struggling at that time is the term of contractual. Is it contractual or not contractual? But whether or not it's contractual or not contractual is basically irrelevant to this context of this standard. So therefore, departing from contractual or not contractual is a good idea. That is what we have discussed. And Mary pointed out a very good point about customer data. So even though we don't have any contractual agreement, so if you have customer data, it's kind of asset. However, we were talking about a little bit further. There is a basic difference between customer relationships and the customer data. Customer data is just information about the customers. Any think tank or any survey company may provide customer data, but the asset we are talking about is more than that. So I would call it rather customer base. In the practice of acquisition, we always talk about what kind of customer base it has. And when I have a lot of experience of purchasing local supermarket, and when we purchase local supermarket, we conduct significant survey of that area, and we will look at the demography and demographic data, and also age, and also average revenue, what is the lifestyle, and what kind of turnover, and then we call it the customer base. So that local supermarket have that customer base which would generate benefit or economic resources. So therefore, if we call it a customer basis, then that would make things much better. Because if we stick to the relationship, then the proposal you made is if you have information or regular contact or not. And the regular contact or information of individual customer is not really relevant. Even if you don't have any regular contact, even if you don't have information of individual faces, but if you know the customer basis profile as a group, that is definitely separable asset. So therefore, we could articulate it in this way.
Is it kind of a parallel to assembled workforce as customer base?
Yeah, a little bit similar. A little bit similar.
Chang Wu?
Thank you. I have the same concern as Kak and Mary. You know, if you see their maybe paper, that says 10, the appendix, and there are customer list and also contractual and non-contractual customer relationships. So I have the same concern. There maybe the target is saying about the non-contractual customer list. So if we just improve this kind of thing here, then still we have problem with this customer list. Still that's non-contractual. So that's the one issue. Another thing I recommend you to do is more precise comparison with our proposal with the FASB's. FASB's, I guess they are just dealing with maybe some customer relationships. So whether I'd like to see the consistency with ours and theirs. That's another recommendation.
Peter?
A couple of points. First of all, I've never found the notion of the contractual customer relationship in IFRS 3 particularly helpful. And to my mind, the distinction is more about whether we're talking about rights and obligations from existing contracts or whether we're talking about the relationship. Yep. For years in the insurance contracts project, we talked about the contract boundary and tried to square the fact that if you've got a 30-year insurance contract, but the customer can cancel, we want to account for all the cash flows we expect from that contract. And there were several of your predecessors who thought that we should label that as a customer relationship rather than the contract, which I think was actually a very unhelpful way of trying to think about it, because actually we were talking about the rights and obligations from the existing contracts. In addition, there was a customer relationship, and you might well have cross-selling and repeat sales and sales to their friends and family and all those kinds of things. But the actual rights and obligations under the contract itself, it just seems to me customer relationship is not a very good label for that part of it. And maybe we should think about whether we've got the right boundary there, the right distinction rather. The second comment I wanted to make was about the description here of what the customer relationship asset is. And the paper suggests that it's the future economic benefits. And I don't think that's quite right, and I think it's important to get it right. And we're trying to emphasize in the conceptual framework project that we're talking about existing rights and obligations, not about possible future flows of economic benefits. And I think the asset we're talking about here is something like the right to benefit from the customer relationship. So you can't force the customer to pay, you can't force the customer to enter into new contracts, but if the customer does, you're the party that's going to benefit from that. And I think there are parallels with employee relationships as well, by the way, as somebody else mentioned. So I think we need to try and actually pin down what the nature of the asset is and make sure we describe it exactly. And then I think we'll be in a better place probably for some of these discussions. Sorry, and just one follow-up, by the way. Tak mentioned customer base. I think that's not the same as customer relationship. What I have in mind for customer relationship is the right to benefit from existing relationships with existing customers. It's not the fact that you might benefit from people who fall into some kind of target group, and there might be some sort of shifting population of people who are in that target group. I think that's a different kind of notion, probably.
And I think it's future benefits from existing customers that are beyond any existing contracts that are already in place.
The control is the challenge there.
Well, the thing you control is your right to benefit from the relationship. Yeah. It's not control of the future benefits that may or may not occur.
Which is why your point about you're not sure we have the definition right.
I did a little bit of just looked up something before the meeting about the utility industry in the UK and about the fact that we've had deregulation competition for about 20 years here, and it's estimated that about 40% of utility customers are still with their existing supplier that they were 20 years ago, and that of there was a survey done by the Competition Markets Authority about a year ago which indicated that 95% of customers who are on a sort of a basic tariff as opposed to one they specifically selected could save. And yet, there is this inertia that is in existing relationships between customers and suppliers. And there is value there, clearly, in that. And I think that's an aspect of what it is that we want to try and pull out and identify in these customer relationships.
Can I respond to the Peters? I take your point, yes. The customer base and the customer relationship is slightly different. But in this context, what we have to achieve here is whether or not it should be a separable asset or not. And if it is not separable, it would be absorbed in goodwill, like a going concern issue. However, in normal practice, especially in the case of acquiring local supermarket or retail stores, what they do is they estimate the value of the customer base which local supermarket have. And then this is definitely separable asset, which is not really going concern issue. And but thing is difficult. When we acquire manufacturer like say for example BMW, so then there are group of customers who really likes BMW. But you know, we have a customer base of BMW. However, it's quite difficult to know whether it's separable from goodwill or not. So those kind of things are the difficult area. So that is what we are going to challenge. And then I think the paragraph 27 literature is very good. For the first sentence, I think this is really good. However, the second sentence is a bit too precise. So if we could improve the second sentence, and we, if we do not label it as a customer relationship, rather than customer relationship, customer base, or whatever, then it could contribute to the improvement of IFRS 3.
I have a question. If we remove the example, illustrative example 23, whether it will create some doubt regarding the portfolio of purchase orders or the production backlog. If I have a portfolio of purchase orders and I know how much profit I'm going to make in fulfilling those orders, I know I can reliably determine how much profit I'm going to realize. It's an assumption. This is currently considered as being contractual in the present guidance, right? Contractual relationship. If we suppress this example, will there be a doubt as to whether this is contractual or non-contractual or customer relationship?
Which example, sorry?
Well, I have a portfolio of purchase orders, order backlog, firm orders from the customer that is currently considered contractual. So you propose to remove this example. Will that removal create any doubt as to the nature of those purchase orders relationship?
I'm proposing to remove the non-contractual bit. Not the contractual.
Okay, not the wall of the example. Okay.
No, so just there will the still be line.
Okay, thanks.
Mary.
I was just going to point out that I think Talk's response to Peter highlighted where some of the tension is in this area, and maybe we have to think about coming at it a slightly different way, because if the staff is saying we'll provide a description of what customer relationship asset is, future economic benefits in the form of future business with a customer beyond the amount secured by any current contractual arrangements. And I understand that in practice what this means is the valuation done is the present value of all future profits expected on transactions with this pool. That's one thing if you can control what transactions they do with you. But if on the one hand we're defining it in such a way that it becomes the present value of probable or possible future transactions measured on an expected value basis, with a desire to stretch the definition of relationship to go, this description, to get, if not all the way to customer base, to very close to it, that seems to me to be shoving too much into what we're calling relationship. So maybe I think it's the combination of the definition, the description/definition, with thinking about what are the things we want to capture, and there may be value in capturing customer base, but I wouldn't say it's the value that would be the present value of expected value all future transactions with them.
That's Peter's point about articulating what's being captured.
So I think that may be part of it, but I think that's why it's important to distinguish customer base from this description. Because this description, as I said, has been operationalized as present value of all future profits.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does the staff know enough? Then we'll take a break until 1:30.